welcome to Connecting the Dots on this fine and glorious Friday. We are here today, as we're here every day, Monday through Friday, to talk about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And we're here today with my good friend, Deacon Stephen Gerdonis. Deacon Stephen Gerdonis. It comes trippingly to the tongue. Have you gotten used to saying that yet, signing your name that way?
Do you know what's the nice thing about it is over the years, all of the people who have accidentally mistyped my name as DSG instead of SDG are now all retroactively right.
Well, see, all things work together for the good of those who are in Christ Jesus, who are called according to his purpose. So there you go. Yeah, it was a prophetic sign was what it was. And so that's why those things happen. I'm just going to go ahead and that's my story and I'm sticking to it. So how's it going? What's new? How's things?
It's good. Okay. Lot to talk about this week. Lots of writing. I'm stepping up my writing, you know, now that I'm done with deacon school. I do have deacon work to do, but I've also been on what I have called academic semi-hiatus from my film writing for the last 4 years.
Yeah.
Really just during the school year in the summers, I tried to keep as busy as possible, but I'm trying to come back full force now. So I'm blogging at the Register, and I wrote a piece for Crux, and I wrote, did we talk about that last week? I don't know. We'll get to that. I wrote a piece for the Register review of Finding Dory, which is in theaters this weekend, and we're going to talk about that.
Okay.
And I blogged a bunch of 60-second reviews, and I also blogged my Real Faith show, which, of course, airs tonight. It airs on Fridays at 8 p.m. Eastern. But I'm afraid I have some disappointing news for you, because you've commented so often since we've been doing this show, and so warmly and effusively about my ability to nail my 60-second reviews in 60 seconds. And this
I never actually listen to a word you say. I'm just sitting there. I'm just watching this. I'm watching that little thing go around, and it's like, is he going to do it? Is he going to make it?
So
I don't know what he's talking about.
My big 60-second review this week, on top of all, you know, I posted a bunch of them because I have a big backlog. But the big new one that I'm excited about is Whit Stillman's Love and Friendship, which I think we talked about last week or the week before. And I talked about it for almost 2 minutes. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I every time now I sit in that chair and I know I'm going to talk for 2 minutes, I feel personally bad, like I'm breaking a commitment to you. I feel like I owe it to you personally to nail those reviews in 60 seconds.
Every time you fail, I'm going to send you a picture of the judgmental tree frog.
Have you seen the Mr. Turtle meme?
No.
Tom McDonald sent me that one once. It's a sea turtle it looks like he's underwater. It looks like he's got his arm. He looks like he's got his flippers folded, like a very disapproving looking father with his arms folded. And the look of his face is just so grim. And the caption says, "Mr. Turtle is not angry. He's just disappointed."
Oh man,
it's great! It's great. You have to Google it.
I remember talking to my brothers about this. The worst thing that we endured from our. I got spankings when I was a kid. You know, I don't remember those things at all. I remember. I think I remember one spanking I got from my dad. Mm. But the really just killer thing was the moment when Dad looked at us and said, "Son, I'm really disappointed in you." So that's fantastic. you there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You got quiet there for a second. Okay. I'm speaking of sea turtles, you know.
And there are sea turtles in Finding Nemo.
Well, I should hope so. I should hope so. Well, why don't we start with Finding Dory? How is it good?
It's good. I enjoyed it. I smiled. I laughed. I even shed a tear or two. There is a moment at the end, which is very touching. And it just, as a parent, it really got me.
Okay.
It is not a patch on the brilliance and greatness that is Finding Nemo.
Okay.
Finding Nemo is one of the best American cartoons that ever made. Certainly, it's a contender for Pixar's best. Uh-huh. And in particular, it is the best animated father-son story, definitely in American animation and maybe anywhere. I haven't seen enough Japanese and Russian and European cartoons to be 100% sure that it's the best, but it might be. It's just wonderful, and it's wonderful because of how they apply one of their defining tropes to the characters of Marlin and Nemo. It takes a dynamic which we've seen in so many other cartoons in which there is a father figure who is in some way either overbearing or overdetermining his child's life. The child is unhappy. The child is chafing. But in the end, the movie cross-examines both the child and the parent. And this movie, unlike, say, How to Train Your Dragon or the Little Mermaid, the story is told as much from the father's point of view as it is from the child. And it isn't all about how the child is right and vindicated and the father is apologetic and sorry in the end. It's mm-hmm. about how both of them grow. And I think that's amazing.
Okay, cool. Now, I hear there's a great octopus. I have a personal investment in octopus.
Do you? Tell me about this.
Well, many people don't know that Puget Sound is home to the giant Pacific octopus. Mm. It is the largest species of octopus on planet Earth, and it is currently about 6 miles away from where I'm sitting out there. And I have strong views on octopuses. Uh-huh.
Do you have those giant kelp forests off of the coast there? Is that because
I don't know. Well, see, Puget Sound is not off the coast. Puget Sound's like this finger of water that sticks down into Washington State. So you cross Puget Sound, and then there's like a whole giant peninsula with an entire colossal mountain range, and then you actually get to the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what's out there. Could be, maybe. I don't know.
Because when I haven't seen a whole lot of giant octopuses or octopi in my life. There's a great one in a nature documentary by Luc Besson called Atlantis, which I just actually rewatched with my kids recently after not having seen it in years and years. Okay. And there's a giant octopus in that thing. He's amazing. It looks like the star of a James Cameron alien movie or something. Really, really freaky looking as he glides through the water with his arms extended. So then they live in these kelp forests, and the kelp forest, there's also a kelp forest in Finding Dory. The premise of Finding Dory is that Dory is hanging out with Marlin and Nemo. I'm not going to give any spoilers, but they're hanging out on the great Australian Barrier Reef. Something happens to Dory, and she regains some memories of her parents. And she realizes that she has to go and look for them. And she winds up going very far from home. She winds up going someplace where there are these giant kelp forests and octopuses. And there's even an octopus in the movie, but that we see in this kelp forest. But the one that matters is the one that she meets in this marine center. It was sort of like a Sea World, except it's more like a sea hospital. They're supposed to rehabilitate the animals and release them into the wild. And Ed O'Neill plays an octopus named Hank, And Hank is a great character. He practically has the run of the Sea Center, the Marine Center, and I found myself wishing at times that he was the protagonist.
Okay. Oh, well, I'm looking forward to it. I think I will probably take my wife to this. I think she'd like it. My kids are currently at the, well, except for my oldest kid, who actually is an animator. Mm-hmm. So he'll want to go see this because partly for professional reasons and partly yes. because he loves it. But my younger kids, you know, currently 20 and 18, they're right at that age where it's like, Dad, uncool, man. You know.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah, well, you know, it happens. But they'll.
C.S. Lewis talks about that in the introduction to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Oh, you know, you're right. That's true.
He talks. He dedicated it to his goddaughter Lucy. Lucy
Barfield.
Barfield, yes, Owen Barfield's daughter, and. He talked about how she, by the time that the book was published, she might be too old to read fairy tales, but that she would get to be old enough to read them again and take it down off the shelf and read it.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. Yep. Well, we will be back with Steve Gradonis right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here on Breadbox Media talking about life at the Bijou. And we'll be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
To Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis talking about life at the Bijou. Just touched on Finding Dory. And, by the way, if you're out there in Radio Land, you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4. 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And you can also tweet us at Breadbox Media. You can, and by the way, you can text us at 1-573-4-BREAD-4. So, what else is happening out there?
Let's talk a little bit more about Finding Dory because I have a few more things I want to point out about it. For one thing, your son, the animations, the animator, and anyone else who's interested in animation. Two things. You definitely want to make sure you get there early enough to see the cartoon short that precedes it. It's called Piper, and it is absolutely adorable and totally cutting edge in terms of the animation technology. It's the story of a little sandpiper hatchling who takes his first steps out of the nest and learns to negotiate the beach and faces his fears and so forth. And so it's the typical Pixar adorable story. Okay. But the animation is just absolutely the photorealism of the grains of sand and the feathers and the foam on the sea foam is just amazing. Your son is also going to be geeking out over the animation on Hank the Octopus because of the way that the stretching and the squashing, they had to develop all new software just to handle him because he's amazing.
Okay.
But the rest of us, and I include myself in that geek category, but also on the other hand, the emotional center of the film has to do with Dory's relationship with her parents, and the movie really casts it as a kind of a situation where you're a parent and you have a child with some kind of special needs or cognitive disability, and that's really the emotional center of the film. We get a little bit of that in Marlin's relationship with Dory, because Dory becomes kind of a responsibility to Marlin, and Marlin is a paternal guy, and so he's looking out for her, because you never know when Dory's going to just forget what's happening and just completely wander off and become lost forever. Mm-hmm. But we also see Dory's parents. We see them first in flashback when she was just a little fry, and they're trying to teach her how to negotiate the world in spite of her special difficulties. And they're using little tricks and things that they can do to help certain things stay in her mind better than, you know, they otherwise would. And any parent who has had a child with special needs, who has had to kind of coach them through those life situations and try to teach them the skills that come naturally and instinctively to most of us, but that some of us have to really kind of memorize and learn and mm-hmm. you know, this is all it's dealt with pretty well. And I think, you know, parents and kids will both connect to it and relate to it. I think that the movie goes a little bit overboard. They've got too many characters that have these issues. There's a beluga whale who has some kind of problem using his sonar, and there's a nearsighted whale shark and various other animals with difficulties. I thought they went a little bit overboard with the theme, but the relationship between Dory and her parents is really kind of endearing and moving. And that's important because that's ultimately what the movie's about.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Now, I saw something a little while ago. There's a Crux list of films for the Year of Mercy that you've had a big hand in.
Well, I wrote about it for Crux.
Okay. Okay. I'm getting my facts mixed up. All right.
Yeah. So let's talk about it.
Okay.
I belong to an online community of film enthusiasts, writers, and other interested parties. Many of us are Christians. Some of us are pastors or are otherwise involved in ministry. The artsandfaith.com goes back to 1999, and it has its roots in film discussion among Christians, but it is a discussion that's open to anyone. Anyone can join in. And for the last 6 years, we have put together top 25 lists for each year. We also have a top 100 film list, the Arts and Faith top 100, that really kind of speaks to the frontier between film and spirituality that kind of defines the culture of the group. And this year, we voted on the top 25 films on mercy. And this was a topic that we always debate and vote on the topic. And so there were a lot of us who liked the idea of mercy. I advocated for it particularly strongly because it was the Year of Mercy. And I said, if we're ever going to do mercy as a theme, now is the year to do it. And well, you know, people will be really interested in because it is this Year of Mercy. And but then it came out this particular week. And, you know, I felt like it was somehow appropriate. There was that horrible mass shooting in Orlando.
Yeah.
And Orlando just got hit really, really hard this week. There was that other shooting, the singer who was shot, and
the
then
little boy and
a horrible story about that little boy at that Disney resort. And you know, and we're just and when we first put together this idea of the top 25 films on mercy, we were not yet fully into what has become the increasing horror show of our current presidential race. And, yeah. You know, all around the world, there's rising global violence, and I was very happy to be able to put this list of films of mercy out there, you know, not because a list of films is going to change anything, but because we could all use a little more mercy in our lives. And this is one of the things that art can do, is to remind us that the way that it is, the way life as we experience it, life in the headlines, that's not the whole story, and it's not the way that it has to be. And we can each make decisions in our lives to make things better in small and local ways. And art can, you know, art can help us to do that. So this is a great list. And there are some great films on here. And they explore the theme of mercy in many and powerful ways.
All right. But well, like what?
So let me start out with the first film on the list. You probably haven't seen it, but you definitely know the protagonist of the film, Monsieur Vincent, 1947, directed by Maurice Clochet. It stars Pierre Fresnay as Saint Vincent de Paul. And Vincent de Paul is his life put this film in the number one spot on our list because, of course, Vincent de Paul was a social reformer whose crusading work in organizing society to care for the poor and the needy, not just with kind of piecemeal charity, but with enduring institutions devoted to this work. This is really the basis for the work of every soup kitchen and every homeless shelter and all of the organized charity that you know is part of our Western social structure. This really goes to Vincent's pioneering work, and so this is a great film, and that's why it's on our list.
All right, fantastic. I've never seen. Is that a Criterion collection film by any chance?
It is not on the Criterion collection. Okay. You can watch it on Amazon. It is available for rent on Amazon Video.
Okay.
Monsieur Vincent, 1947. It's also one of the 45 films in the Vatican film list.
Okay.
So it's on two great lists of great films, and so you should definitely watch it.
Okay, cool.
Some of the films on the list you have heard of, we've talked of before, Of Gods and Men is on here. David Lynch's The Elephant Man. The 1951 version of Scrooge starring Alistair Sim.
Oh, yeah. That's a great performance. You know, it really is.
Uh-huh.
The guy was born to play Scrooge. keep going.
And that's, you know, it really is a story about mercy. In this case, it's a story about, you know, the universe offering mercy to this man who has shown mercy to no one else in his life. Mm-hmm. And there's a principle in the Gospels, of course, that the one who shows mercy to him, mercy will be shown. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. But sometimes it works the other way. Sometimes when the world has been merciful to you, it helps you to be more merciful.
Yeah.
And Jesus certainly expects that of us. Yeah. He expects that because God has forgiven our sins, that we should be able to forgive the sins of other people. And he tells that terrible, terrible parable about the ungrateful servant whose debt was forgiven but was unable to forgive the smaller debt of his fellow servant, and how angry the king was at him. And
right.
he makes it very clear that, you know, if we don't respond with forgiveness to those who offend us, that we're not going to get any forgiveness from God.
Right, which is, of course, terrifying. You know, one of the interesting things about the gospel, and I haven't really worked it out either. It's not something I understand very clearly. So I get, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. And I get the, you know, if you do not forgive, neither will your Father in heaven forgive you.
Mm-hmm.
That I get. But curiously, Paul then, so in Jesus' teaching, forgiveness for us is predicated on our forgiveness for others.
Mm-hmm.
But Paul turns that around and he says, forgive even as you have been forgiven. And I get it, and I certainly see how it works. You know, I get that the gospel is grace, but I haven't fully worked out the relationship between Jesus's preaching on mercy, which basically is putting all the responsibility on us first. If you want forgiveness, then you must forgive. And Paul, who says, since you've been forgiven, then you must forgive.
Right.
That's an interesting paradox that I haven't ironed out completely. I just try to play it safe and forgive.
And I haven't done a study of all of these passages in relation to each other. I mean, obviously, Jesus' teaching is foundational for us as Catholics, but we tend to frame our theology from a Pauline perspective, because Paul is commenting on Jesus in the gospel. Jesus is kind of looking forward to a redemption that hasn't yet been accomplished, and Paul is looking back on one that has. And that can very often color the way that they approach it. Theologically, yeah. Our faith is very clear that yeah. God's grace and God's mercy comes to us first.
Right.
God reaches out to us before we've done anything to reach out to him, and he gives us his mercy first.
Right.
And then on the basis of having received forgiveness, then we're expected to forgive our neighbor. And Jesus does that too. Like I said, in the example of the parable of the ungrateful servant,
right.
first exactly. the servant is forgiven and then he's expected to show mercy. So what I think Jesus is saying is, even if you've received mercy already, you need to show mercy to others. Otherwise, the mercy that you've received is not going to be enough. God's not going to keep on giving you mercy.
Okay.
If you don't then share that mercy with others. That's how I would see it.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Yeah, it is. I mean, it's one of the most terrifying parables, because of course, you know, every day, I mean, there are people that just drive me.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Mark Shay, and we're here today with Stephen Gardanis, talking about life at the movies, talking about films for the Year of Mercy, and you know there's so many good ones out there. It's interesting, you know, ones that make and don't make the list. One thing I don't think it made the list, but certainly one that has one of the most powerful scenes of redemption I think ever put on
film. I think I know what movie you're going to say.
The Mission.
I knew it.
Yeah. with Robert De Niro as the redeemed slaver.
Jeremy Irons.
Yeah, if that doesn't just, you know, rip your guts out when you see that scene.
Yeah. It's an extraordinary scene, and the movie was, the screenplay was written by Robert Bolt, who also wrote the screenplay, of course, for A Man for All Seasons.
Great writer.
Yeah. And despite not being a believer, a great writer of Christian characters and of the Christian ethos.
Yeah.
And he portrays a man who acts with understandable passions. At first, he is a slaver because this serves him economically, and he's a ruthless man, and he does what he does for his own well-being. And then he gets into a duel, and he kills someone who is very dear to him for reasons that, you know, if you understand the psychology of the time period, they're very understandable. But after he's done this, he can't ever forgive himself for what he's done. He's in despair. He sees no possibility of mercy or grace for himself. And he turns to this priest who challenges him and says that redemption is possible. And it's like a contest between the two men. Because Mendoza, the slaver, he will not give himself slack. He will not give himself grace. And Jeremy Irons, the priest, he gives him hard penance, and he will not lighten it because he recognizes that if he cracks first, then Mendoza's guilt will have triumphed. Mm-hmm. And the screenplay sets up this contest between these two men, and there doesn't seem to be any way out. And then, I'm not going to say what happens, but the way out comes, and it's just breathtaking, and it's completely convincing. It's convincing psychologically and spiritually and cinematically. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, yeah, just an amazing piece of work. Yeah, it really is. If you've never seen, I mean, it's a hard film to watch. Partly because, of course, it's grappling with you know, the disastrous, in many ways, institutional response of the church to the engagement of Europeans with Native Americans in the New World. And I hasten to add, of course, that the institutional response was not always disastrous. You also get, for example, the great Dominican Bartolomé de las Casas is the guy who really laid the groundwork for the church's entire critique of slavery in the New World, and lays the groundwork for a lot of work that's going to be done later on, including in the American founding. For conceptions of human liberty, and why is slavery bad? This is amazingly, this is a question that people had to work through. But we forget that for most of the history of the human race, slavery is the room temperature relationship of human being to human being until the Christian tradition comes along and really starts to interrogate that. Anyway, I'm getting off base here, but very that powerful film, movie to watch.
The yeah. Mission is also one of the 45 films on the Vatican film list.
As well that it should be.
And Monsieur Vincent are both among the 15 that are in the religion category. It did not make our top 25 films on Mercy. It easily could have. I'm almost certain that it was in the top 50 anyway in our among our finalists. So this is a great list. There are films here that are going to be familiar to you, films that you'll never have heard of. I'm very pleased with how represented the list is. And one of the things that you do when you're a cinephile and you're looking at a film list is you look to see, where is the kind of the center of gravity here. A lot of lists, they're very heavy on recent films and only a few older films, or, they're all American or European films and very few films from the wider world. And I look at this list and I see films from South and East Africa and Japan and Hong Kong and Russia, as well as Europe and the United States, and only 10 films from the last dozen years or so. So no, only six films from the last dozen years. And then,
what are they? I'm curious.
The recent ones?
Yeah.
The most recent one is from 2 years ago. It's called Love and Mercy, and it's from Bill Pohled, and it is a brilliant biographical film about the life of Brian Wilson, the musical genius behind the Beach Boys.
Interesting.
He's the character is actually played by two different actors at two different points in his life. Paul Dano plays Wilson as a younger man at the point of his the height of his musical genius, when he was working through the experimental the musical experiments that would lead to the Beach Boys album Pet Sounds. And okay. Then John Cusack plays him as an older man, having succumbed to mental illness and really being subjected to abusive treatment by someone who's taking advantage of him. And then there's the character of Elizabeth Banks, who plays a Cadillac saleswoman who encounters him and remembers him for his music and becomes the icon of grace in his life. And it, the movie really becomes about the relationship of love and mercy and, the saving power of love. It's at some points also a hard film to watch, but one that I highly recommend. I believe it's streaming on Amazon, Love and Mercy. And that was from 2014.
Interesting. Your name isn't Beatrice, is it? Just be interesting if it was, but go ahead.
The oldest film on the list from 1921 is Charlie Chaplin's The Kid, and it's a really good example of that stream of empathy and humanism that runs through many of Chaplin's films and is the reason that them Modern Times is also one of the films in the Vatican film list.
Okay, interesting. I think one of the things that Chaplin, and this is a theme that shows up in all the great silent comedians, of course, but I think Chaplin really exemplifies it better than anybody, is that Chaplin understood right away that your hero needs to be an underdog. Nobody likes a hero. Nobody likes a hero who wins, right? You like a hero who's always he's the guy that's on the down and out, and you know. So I mean, his character's a tramp, you know. But that it was Chesterton makes the remark that giants who tread down forests like grass are the creations of humility, and that picture of the world that comes from underneath, from that was where Chaplin came from. I mean, he grew up dirt poor himself, and he understood that most of his audience were dirt poor, and that comes through in all of his films, that empathy for the person who needs mercy. So anyway,
empathy is a really important theme for engaging in cinema, and for this list in particular. I love something that Roger Ebert, he actually has a couple of very interesting comments about movie and empathy. He's called movies the most powerful engines for producing empathy that mankind has ever devised. And he talks about how a movie, in a unique way, a way more than even literature and other art forms, movies have the ability to, as he put it, take us out of our personal box of time and space and invite us to empathize with people of other times, places, races, creeds, classes, and prospects. In watching a movie, you can experience something of what it's like to live in another country, to be of another socioeconomic strata, to hold a different religion, to be a different sex, a different age. And in doing that, in escaping the limitations of your own daily experience, you are opened up to empathy to the other. And without empathy, there can be no true community, and even no, ultimately, according to Edith Stein, Saint Edith Stein, no true knowledge of the self. You can't know who you are unless you can see yourself through the eyes of other people. Because right, part of the truth of yourself, you're always going to be blind to knowing yourself from the inside.
Well, you're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
Darling, oh my darling Clementine. Hi.
Stop that.
Just needed to be said. Welcome back. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gerdonis. You were making a point before the break that got drowned out a bit by Ludwig about right, how film is a great engine of empathy, that it's the strongest medium that we have for helping to create empathy with the other.
And I want to put a caveat on that, because Ebert, who made these remarks, is talking about what he calls real movies or the good movies. Now, of course, movies have the ability to do the exact opposite too. And Pope Pius I, in the first papal encyclical on the subject of motion pictures, Vigilante Cura, writes about this. He talks about the dangers and the damage that can be done by bad motion pictures. And among these, he says bad motion pictures can generate suspicion and hostility between classes and peoples and whole nations. And so movies can be used to perpetuate prejudicial stereotypes and hostilities of all kinds between, you know, economic classes, social classes, races, everything, you name it. You don't have to look any further than, say, the Japanese stereotypes and propaganda films from World War II to see that.
Yeah.
And in the same way that, you know, we've looked to these films and these 25 films on our list to celebrate the theme of mercy, but movies can also push us in the opposite direction. The revenge movie is one of the most enduring genres in Hollywood history. But this is one of the reasons why I love and why I recommend foreign films and older films and films that are different from what you would normally experience, because movies have the ability to offer us this imaginative experience of life in some vein other than the ones in which we naturally live it. And this act of moving out of ourselves is the fundamental business of being human. This is what God calls us to. This is what it means to be a person and to be called to community. It's this movement of stepping out of yourself and stepping out of the tribal alliances to me and my family and people who look like me, who have the same skin color as me and talk the same way as I do and live in my neighborhood, and empathizing with people who look different and sound different. This is what it means to be a Christian, ultimately, a Catholic.
Yeah. And this reminds me of something that just happened today on Facebook. It's been, you know, we've been hearing, and it just got pushed into overdrive, of course, with the outrage in Orlando. The great fear of the other, the refugee. You know, Trump immediately took to Twitter to high-five himself after the slaughter and say, you know, I'm awesome because I was right. It was an amazingly callous thing to do. And then immediately went to give speeches saying that this man was, quote, an Afghan. An Afghan is a blanket, not a person. His parents were refugees from Afghanistan. Well, his parents were immigrants from Afghanistan who came here in the 1980s, because Afghanistan at that time was our ally, and they were busy fighting the Soviets. His family emigrated here. He was born here. The shooter was born here. He was an American citizen. But nonetheless, of course, all the drumbeat of fear of refugees has sounded even more strongly, and so on and so forth. Well, there's a rather well-known Catholic singer. Many of our listeners are probably familiar with her. Her name is Audrey Assad. You may notice that last name bears a strong similarity to someone else, Bashar Assad, who is the tyrant in Syria, because her father was a Syrian refugee who came here. And not surprisingly, Audrey has strong views about the dignity of refugees. And I watched this video of her. She's basically calling us to a day for honoring refugees. I think it's on June 26th. I'm not sure. You'd want to look up Audrey Assad and refugees to get all the details. But what really struck me in watching the video was it put a face on the people that a man like Donald Trump is drumming up fear of. Because when he's saying that refugees and the children of refugees are a menace and we need to kick them out and on and on and on, he means Audrey Assad. That face there, that person that I know, who I think the world of, that's who we're talking about when we're talking about the terrifying other that we need to punish in exile. And that's what a visual medium does for us. That's what film can do for us at its best, is it shows us the face of these people that we want to just, we want to abstract them out of our minds. We want to, you know, we want to heap on them all of our fears and our terrors and so forth, and punish them for that. What film does is it says, this is the person you're talking about. This person here, right here with these struggles and this pain and these glorious traits and, you know, that gorgeous singing voice and this child that they love, that's the person that you're talking about. And it becomes so much harder at that moment to of that person and turn them into a scapegoat and heap all of your fears and terrors on them because now you know them.
It's interesting that you repeatedly use that phrase, the face of the other. One of the three filmmakers who appears on our list of the top 25 films on Mercy twice are the Dardenne brothers, from the Belgian filmmakers that we've talked about before on this show. They made one of my favorite movies from last year and one of my favorite movies from a few years before. Kid with a Bike is one of the films on our list. And a film writer that I know, Doug Cummings, has written what is really one of the most important essays on the Dardenne brothers. And his essay is called Responding to the Face of the Other. Because this is really a central organized principle around the Dardennes' work. The Dardennes are not religious, but they did have Catholic upbringing and a Catholic education, and that has shaped their humanistic and their moral perspective. And their films are fundamentally about how people respond when they are confronted with the face of the other, when they're confronted by somebody who is in need, someone who either has some claim on them or someone who has no claim on them but really needs them to intervene. And how people respond to that defines them morally. And sometimes they respond with amazing heroism, and sometimes they respond with crushing selfishness and moral failure. And their films, the films of the Dardenne brothers, including the two films that are on this list, The Kid with the Bike and The Son, are among the most outstanding explorations of empathy and very often of it's the related theme of mercy of any films that I've ever seen.
You know, a film that does that in a surprising way, considering how unbelievably dark it is The Dark Knight, with a villain who is that's all he wants to do is he just wants to show that people are monsters, just like him, and he tries his best to make that case. And in this, you know, amazing sort of turn of grace at the end of the at the end of the film, people don't do what he expects them to do, and they, in fact, they behave with courage and with charity, and that's a remarkable denouement to that story, because that story is so unremittingly nihilistic in that villain.
Yes.
That it was so, and coming from that director, who is Christopher Nolan, is not Mr. Sunshine.
No, he's, and I sometimes find him too dark for my tastes, but I right. absolutely agree with you on the ending of this film.
Yeah. Yeah. And even, you know, to the point where, you know, you really do have, you know, the Batman sort of, you know, if you will, not taking the sins of the world on himself, but at least taking the sins of Gotham City on himself, you know, and allowing himself to become this sort of victim soul. You know, he's running because he can, because we can, you know, sort of that speech that Commissioner Gordon gives at the end, you know. Where Batman becomes sort of this man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and, you know, we heap all the sins of Gotham City on him. that also was remarkable to me, to see something like that. And in its own way, you know, in Christopher Nolan's very dark way, is a curious affirmation, maybe not of mercy, but of something like, Christian heroism filtered through a very strange universe.
Well, Steve Granados, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. I'm listening to Connecting the Dots. And glad to have you.